This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, scientists and entrepreneurs held a closed-door, invite-only meeting at Harvard to discuss idea from the realm of science fiction, manufacturing a human genome, human cells with the genetic instructions made from scratch, no parents needed. You can imagine what happened next. Biologists, ethicists, theologians responded swiftly and forcefully, saying it's not up to scientists and industry to make this sort of decision, especially behind closed doors. Scientists may have the expertise to pursue these projects, the critics said, but not the authority. The organizers of the conference later dialed it back a little. They stressed that the idea was not to build a person with the technology, just cells in a dish. And they said the focus would not be on synthetic human genomes. They'd study creating synthetic animal and plant genomes, too. But who would that work benefit? If it was publicly funded, would all the taxpayers footing the bill, including the most underrepresented members of our society, ever see a benefit? By the way, building a synthetic genome as big as a human isn't that easy to pull off, either. Even if a project like this did get the green light, it would face a lot of technical and economic challenges. So where do you weigh in on this? Give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. The meeting's organizers declined an invitation to join us today, so we're going to have to catch up with them next time, hopefully. My next guests are Jeffrey Way, Senior Staff Scientist at the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering. That's at Harvard Med School. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Laurie Zoloff is a professor at Northwestern University, and she's also past president of both the American Academy of Religion and the American Society of Bioethics and Humanities. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Vey, you were at the meeting. Dr.
Wyss,
right. what was the purpose? To hash out technical details, discuss the fundamental models, public or private? What was going on there?
What was going on primarily was scientific talks by people who were doing research related to the potential synthesis of the human genome. And so they were talks about making DNA, talks about some of the medical uses that people might be able to attack with if you had this technology, diseases like Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, various genetic disorders, organ transplants, and so forth. And also people working on the basic technologies that might underlie being able to do this.
So no one was going to the meeting saying, hey, we're coming here to learn how to build a human genome.
No. The people who came want to do it, are interested in doing it, and maybe have something to offer. But I think the main spirit of the meeting was that this is, in fact, a daunting process. The idea of doing this is technologically really impossible right now, and it's a very desirable goal because, as you rattled off, synthesis of a variety of different genomes would be extremely useful, especially plant genomes to solve potential world hunger issues, animal genomes for making better agricultural animals, and so forth, and also just for studying the basics of how genomes work. But really doing it from scratch is just daunting. The expense, the time, the effort, whether it's possible or not, is an open question. And that was really the spirit of the meeting, is how challenging it is and how should we organize such a large project.
So why was the meeting closed to the press and the public then?
I think the project is at such an early stage that if you have the press present, then there would be a certain level of self-censorship because people would be basically afraid of saying something stupid that would then end up the next day in the press and create all sorts of unnecessary controversy when really you want to be able to think out loud, say things that upon reflection or upon just hearing them articulated might be a little silly or might sound like you're trying to create a monster and so forth. But you want an atmosphere of freedom to have those discussions, and then once you coalesce around a plan, then that would be kind of presented to the public.
Dr. Zoloff, you and the biologist Drew Endy responded to the meeting news with an essay that says, hold on, this project is not ready for prime time yet.
correct. We had three points, and one of which is just a factual thing. There was a press release put out by Autodesk 3 or 4 weeks before the meeting was held saying exactly that. We're going to make a human genome. We're going to set up this process this year, and within a decade, we'll have this project underway. So we were alarmed because the meeting had a clear intent to create a human genome. That's why it was called Human Genome Project 2, like point two of a science project. And we were concerned about several things. One is, who was invited to have this discussion? Was it ever asked, not how can we do this, but if we should do it or not? The ethical question, is this the right act and what makes it so? And finally, synthetic biology has been marked from the very beginning by including a wide swath of people, including bioethicists, including theologians, including civil society groups who had something to say. Bioethics has never been excluded, and theologians and civil society groups have never been excluded to this extent before. We've always known that there was meetings going on. Many meetings were open. People were invited to make presentations. Because we believe that science from the very beginning is a public project, is a project of a whole society, and that's why ethics has to be asked and queried at the very beginning of any project in science. There's no such thing as a privatized science project.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, how do you answer that? You don't seem to believe, from what you said, that this should be closed eventually, all the way.
Of course not. Of course not. First of all, if it remains closed, we'll never get the money to do it. What we need to do is create a concrete plan. The idea, as Dr. Zoloth said, is already out there, and people are welcome to debate it. Should we create a cell? And that's all we're doing, just a cell with a synthetic human genome in it. Should we do that? That's something that people can talk about right now. How to do it is a difficult question. Simply coming up with a roadmap, it's like building a bridge or a huge building or a battleship. It really is expensive, it requires a lot of planning, and everybody would like to come up with that plan before essentially asking various sources for money. You need to have a sensible plan to put forth to the public.
Dr. Zoloth, we had the Human Genome Project, sequencing of the human genome, and I don't recall there being this much pushback on that idea.
Well, I want to say two things. One is, the reason there wasn't pushback, because from the beginning, it was conceived as a project that had a certain proportion of public funds for ethical, legal, and social implications of the science itself. This was called the ELSI projects. This was an attempt to say, in the beginning, as we begin to discover this, let's think with bioethicists and theologians and social scientists and lawyers about the implications of such a project. So it was never separate. It was never put in place and then asked about it afterward. Science welcomed ethical discourse from the very beginning of the Human Genome Project. And as I said, that's been commonplace ever since, to include bioethicists and theologians and in their many and diverse numbers into the formation of the project itself, so that the parameters, the epistemological considerations, what is of value and what is not of value, are set as part of a collaborative discourse. And that was absent in this meeting. But actually, ironically enough, here's what's happened. We wanted two things. One was, we wanted it to be an open meeting and to have a full public discourse. And a conversation like this is clearly the beginning of that discourse. And secondly, we said, don't do humans. To build the tools and the technologies, create the science around not human biological cells, around cells that would have some meaning for public health, that there'd be a strong reason to create, for instance, an adaptive rice genome or a mosquito genome, other things besides humans, because the creation of humans is not a scientific problem, it's a theological problem. It goes to the core of the question, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be free? And those assumptions have to be built into any efforts at creating a human genome.
Jeff Way, your reaction?
My reaction is that, first of all, if we called this project the Rice Genome Project, we would have a lot more difficulty getting funding than if, and honestly, that was part of the consideration. We will develop technologies that will be applicable to all these different organisms, but implicit in that is the capability of synthesizing a human genome. If we say we're going to make the rice genome or the cow genome, then hidden in there is the same technology that would allow you to build a human genome. And so they all go together. And I think calling it the Human Genome Project 2, or the Human Genome Project Right instead of Read, just makes plain. It's a kind of an honest admission that that technology is embedded in what we're trying to do.
What kind of funding, Jeff? What kind of money in terms of a budget are we talking about here? Let's say if you want a complex large genome in 10 years, what ballpark?
The ballpark discussion is in the range of $100 million, but honestly, I mean, I realize I'm on the radio. I want to say don't quote me. This is why we need a plan. It could be less, a little bit less than that. It's hard to imagine much less than that. It's easy to imagine a lot more than that because right now you can do calculations about simply the cost of chemical synthesis of a human genome. Just how much chemicals do you need to make all those base pairs, 3 billion base pairs? And it's a lot. It's a few cents a base. And so already you're talking at today's prices, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. And then there's the lab work to assemble it into bigger pieces and put it into cells and so forth.
Dr. Zarloff, would you welcome another more inclusive meeting?
I would welcome another more inclusive meeting, and I'd like the meeting to begin not with how we do this and how do we enact it and how do we fund it, but if we should do it or not. Should $100 million be spent with this sort of science project, admittedly very difficult, with an unclear goal, a hand-waving goal of human health, or should there be $100 million spent to figure out how to get clean water to millions of people around the world that don't have clean water, or how to do something about malaria? Every 30 seconds, a child dies of malaria. $100 million in scientific research could go a long way towards
that. In all fairness, you could make that argument about every sort of project there is. You know,
and that's why every single project there is has an IRB review, has a social implications, thoughtful discussion surrounding it. A major new project to create a human genome needs to have a public discussion to decide if it's worth it and if it's ethical.
All right, I think we've started it here today. Jeff Way, senior science staff scientist at the Wyss Institute of Biological Inspired Engineering at Harvard, and the Laurie Zarloff Professor at Northwestern University. And she's also past president of the American Academy of Religion and American Society of Bioethics and Humanities. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue the discussion of genetics and what it means to be human and take a look how we have addressed these issues in the past with Siddhartha Mukherjee. Great new book, The Gene. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The idea that we might one day synthesize a human genome, maybe sooner rather than later, forces us to think about the future. Will we ever develop the technology to build a human being from scratch? Is it just a matter of time? And under what circumstances would we do it? Who will decide? We all start thinking a little like science fiction writers, don't we? But maybe we should also be thinking like historians. Last week, I read a book called The Gene, A Sweeping History of Human Genetics, from Mendel's pea plans to the gene editing technique CRISPR. Turns out the history of genetics is a history of ethical conundrums, and it's a history we can all learn from. Siddhartha Mukherjee is the author of The Gene, An Intimate History. He's also the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, and an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Mukherjee.
Well, thank you for having me.
What did you think when you heard the news that geneticists were discussing synthesizing the human genome?
To me, of course, it's astonishing news still, but it seems to be a natural progression. We've been synthesizing longer and longer pieces of DNA. These used to be very expensive to make. The costs have come down. And we're stringing them longer and longer pieces together. You know, in our laboratory, for instance, when we do our own work, we used to have to do very complicated steps to create mutations or make changes in genes. Now we just sort of order them out, and they send them in. You know, they can be 2,000 ATGCCCs, etc. long. So I think it's there are enormous technological challenges that remain. But on the other hand, I also see it lying within the reach of future technology.
Does this frighten you that we're able to do this?
Yes, I'm apprehensive about how we want to use this information. I'm apprehensive about what people will think about doing with it in the future. I mean, is it going to be a proof of principle and we're going to stop there, or are we going to go a little bit beyond that and try to make artificial genomes more to specifications? I suspect it's going to stop by itself. I suspect there'll be strong barricades around it. Scientists have put up barricades around these kinds of ideas before, and it's important to prove the principles. But I do think that we will manage to put up barricades. I'm optimistic about that.
Let's talk about those barricades, because in particular, you write about another sensitive scientific meeting in your book where scientists discussed what they could do and what they should do. And I'm talking about the Asilomar Conference in 1975.
Right. Incredibly important conference. And that meeting, the Asilomar meeting, was held in California soon after a group of scientists, including Paul Berg and Stan Cohen and Herb Boyer, began to figure out that you could take genes from different species. You could take a gene from a bacterium and you could stitch it together with a gene from a virus or a human gene, and you could put it into a frog cell. And because the genetic code is universal, the frog cell would think that it was a frog gene. There's no way that it would know it any differently. And you could now make human proteins in a frog cell or a bacterial gene, et cetera. So there's a quote in the book. I say, there's a moment where we say, species are specious. So in the wake of those stunning discoveries, later called, or actually already then called, recombinant DNA, that you could combine any two pieces of DNA, scientists and legal scholars and some bioethicists and journalists had actually an open meeting. They were invited, but you could write about it. And that meeting was Asilomar, and they decided to temporarily impose a self-moratorium on the use of these gene hybrids, so that you wouldn't all of a sudden unleash biological catastrophe in the world. And that moratorium was very effective.
You noted that was an open meeting to the press compared to the meeting last week, which was closed.
That's right. So, I mean, I think my impression is that the meeting was closed because the technologies are too premature. I don't think that the meeting, I mean, I wasn't at the recent meeting. I don't think the meeting discussed, here's what we're going to do, and here's how we're going to string together, several billion little bits of chemicals to make the human genome, an artificial human genome. I think the meeting was should we embark it on it as a proof of principle? How much money would it entail? I obviously would have preferred it if it was open, because we would know these questions right now.
Mm. In your new book, you really invited readers into these ethical debates. Was that part of the motivation for writing the book, to get everybody involved in talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, I think everyone should be talking about it. And, I think here we are raising questions about, who are we? Who gets to decide how to synthesize something that has so much to do with yourself, your identity? We want to eliminate diseases. We want to eliminate suffering. How do we use genes to do that in a way that's safe and does not compromise the future? So that debate cannot be had in an isolated place. It has to be had in the most public forum possible, because it concerns you. It concerns me. It concerns my children. It concerns my future.
Because are we at a turning point in history right now with the gene?
We are. I mean, we've progressively inched towards that turning point, and you can watch the steps happen. Particularly, I mean, in the last 20 years, I try to walk us through that moment. How do we get here today when we're sitting in this studio and asking questions like, should we be making artificial human genomes? Should we be manipulating or changing the human genome intentionally? Well, how do we get here? Well, we need to know, in order to have this discussion in an ethical forum and say, this is the next things that would be permissible, this would not be permissible, we need to be able to have the vocabulary and understand how the technology brought us here.
Because you say in your book that not only is the gene one of the most powerful, but it is one of the most dangerous ideas in science.
And the word dangerous is very key. I mean, we all know we want to use genetics and genes for human emancipation. We want to eliminate terrifying diseases, or cure, or at least treat them using genetic technologies. But it's dangerous because more than once in our history, recent history, we've watched the idea of heredity being perverted.
Eugenics,
and what's amazing about eugenics is that if you were a progressive kind of fellow in the 1910s in England, you would very much want to believe that, that you know, one way to emancipate human beings, one way to make better human beings, would be through selected breeding. And yet that same idea, 30 to 40 years later in Nazi Germany, switches from selective breeding to selective elimination of the weak, you know, extermination. And so the road to that eugenics hell is paved through progressive beliefs at first, which slowly morph into the macabre Nazi eugenics that we know about.
That's very surprising.
Yeah, to me. And, you know, there's an American interlude to this, too. It's an important American interlude, which you couldn't forget, which is that after the idea was born and bred in England, often among progressives, although not all progressives believe it, it actually metastasized first to America. It was America that sort of brought up, you know, if eugenics was born, its early adolescence was spent in America, where, again, that idea of, you know, how do we change the human race? How do we make it better? You know, remember the Better Babies contest?
Yeah.
And Carrie Buck.
Carrie Buck, you write about. You tell us about who Carrie Buck was.
So Carrie Buck is an important character. I should dedicate the book partly to her. She was a woman who was sterilized on the pretext that she carried a gene for, or maybe more than one gene, for imbecility, which was never proven. In fact, if you look back at her records, I mean, more than one book has been written about her. If we look back at her records, you find out, in fact, that the evidence that she was carrying genetic form of imbecility was very, very poor. And yet, she was forcibly sterilized. The Supreme Court basically ordered that she could be sterilized for the betterment of society because no one wanted, you know, the famous opinion was 3 generations of imbeciles is enough. That was the
But you couldn't do that today. Well, what has changed over that period?
Well, we've learned, I think, how to stop ourselves from going over that abyss. We've learned that that genes, our genetics, is more complex. We've learned how dangerous the seduction is of trying to use heredity in this manner. We've learned hard lessons through the Nazi experience. As we watched in horror, we've learned many of these things. The question is, have we learned enough, and will we be able to use these lessons in the near future?
Speaking of learning, let's talk about another very famous case that taught us something, and I'm speaking about Jesse Gelsinger. Tell us what happened there.
So Jesse Gelsinger was a young boy who had a very mild form of genetic disease that had affected his liver, among other things. And he decided to enroll in a trial of gene therapy, one of the first trials. And the night before he was going to be injected with a virus containing the corrected gene, there were some abnormalities noticed in his body, some physiological abnormalities. But the team decided to go ahead. He had a terrible immune reaction to the virus. We think immune reaction, a terrible reaction to the virus. And he died as a consequence of that.
And he was not really informed. His father, you write about his father, who was still alive, did not feel that he was adequately informed about what the hazards
were. That's right. And there's a regret there that the father was not fully informed about what the potential risks were of a procedure. It was clearly risky.
And what's the lesson? What do we take away from that?
Well, we learned a lot of lessons from that experience, too. We learned about how to control. We learned about what the scientific problems were with using, you know, the irony is that they had decided to use a common cold virus, basically, to deliver the genes, hoping that it was very bland. It was not something very weird and outside the box. The irony is that that's probably one of the reasons, that he had an immune reaction. He'd probably seen or been exposed to that same virus before or some cousin of it. And, you know, sometimes, again, it's only in retrospect that we figure out what the scientific challenges might have been.
Mm-hmm. I want to read another quote from your book, which is, you write, "Our capacity to understand and manipulate human genomes alters our conception of what it means to be human." What did you mean by that?
Well, the idea here is that once we start saying to ourselves that the human genome is not something that you inherit by virtue of who, by chance, you happen to have as your parents, but it's something that we can change, that, you know, that we can, I call it two phases, reading and writing. By reading, I mean you can use the genome, you can look at this gene sequence, and in a probabilistic way, say that the probability of you becoming this or developing that disease in the future may be 10%, 20%. Even though it's not certainty, that idea begins to change who we are as human beings. All of a sudden you say, well, okay, now I live in the shadow of a future illness that I may or may not have. Or take the case of writing, in which you say, you know, I can change something in the human genome. Then you say, well, okay, what does it mean to change pieces of oneself, particularly in embryonic cells? I mean, what does it mean to push into that arena? So I think that idea begins to change how we think of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Are we very close to genetically modifying humans? I mean, with the CRISPR technique and the tools?
I think there will be strong barricades against this. At least in the United States, there'll be strong barricades. I think there's a precedent for this. We've talked about Asilomar before. I think the trials of gene therapy and other biological, ethical situations have taught us how to stop when we need to stop. So that doesn't worry me so much at present. But what worries me, of course, is that internationally, people have different standards. So the first experiment, attempted experiment to modify a human embryo, was performed in China. Now, there were non-viable embryos, so the experiment wasn't a free-for-all. But nonetheless, the first experiment was performed in China. And so we have to ask ourselves, well, is this going to become a kind of arms race? Is it going to become other people are going to enter it? Where will we, what will we do? And as I said, the important stakes here, the important stakes might be you could potentially cure terrible diseases or treat terrible diseases with these technologies.
Mm-hmm. Casey just joined us. We're talking with Siddhartha Mukherjee, who is a cancer physician and author of the new book, The Gene in Intimate History, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Is it inevitable that once the technology exists that you talked about the Chinese starting down that road, that somebody is going to try to make a human, synthetic human?
I don't think it's inevitable, partly because I think the synthetic human question is yet another technological leap, a wrinkle, as it were. I mean, it's you know, we I think that the we are far away from being able to make these giant collections of strings of letters. I think it will take quite a lot of technology to get there. It has become cheaper. It has become somewhat possible. It still remains a pipe dream. And I think that by that time, I hope that by that time, we'll have figured out where to stop. I mean, do we stop at a proof of principle and then say, okay, we know how to do this, now we're going to stop?
You have your own manifesto about.
I have some recommendations about
it.
Yes,
absolutely. Three main ones, I understand.
Well, I like to think about it as a triangle. And just to inform us about this triangle, I mean, one edge of the triangle. So the question is, under what circumstances should we be using genetic manipulations? Should it be permissible? Where should we be applying this technology? So one edge of the triangle, at least for me as a physician, is that there has to be extraordinary suffering involved. I mean, this is, you know, we cannot possibly want to use these technologies lightly. It can't be to change the color of your hair or to change other things that may or may not be related to genes anyway. So has to be some extraordinary suffering. The second is that there has to be the relationship between the gene and the expected effect has to be very tight. There's a word in biology called penetrance, and that is to say that, you know, if you have a gene that only has a 10% chance of producing an expected effect, it's unlikely that we should want to tamper with those because the chance is so minimal. And the third, probably the most important, is that all of us, this should be done without state mandate. It should be done without someone forcing you to test the genetics of your child. It should be done without someone telling you, you know, this is the way we would like you to manipulate, you know. So historically, we've stuck within the boundaries of this triangle. It seems to me now the question that's arising more and more is, should we step out of one of these boundaries? And that, to me, is the crucial question.
It's something we need all to discuss transparently, together,
exactly,
yep. And out in the open.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you very much. We've run out of time. Very interesting book. I'm talking about The Gene in Intimate History, talking with Siddhartha Mukherjee, who is a cancer physician and author of The Gene in Intimate History. He's also assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And you can read an excerpt from The Gene at our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/gene. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we'll hear about the early struggles to get GPS off the ground and into our everyday lives, the story of that near miss, and how he got back on track. The father of GPS is going to be here. Stay with us for a conversation with Brad Parkinson after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The U.S. Navy has announced plans to teach sailors how to navigate with ancient technology, the sextant and the stars. So why in this age of GPS would the Navy resurrect celestial navigation? Because GPS is highly vulnerable to jamming. Imagine a world without GPS. It would literally come to a standstill. And if you heard our conversation with author Greg Milner a couple of weeks ago, you have some sense of the unexpected ways GPS has changed our lives, from urban transit to sugar beet farming. Well, that's why it's hard to believe that GPS was an invention that first went unwanted. In the early 1970s, the Air Force was working on a satellite-assisted navigation system, but the military brass felt the resources would be better spent on building more airplanes. My next guest was a tireless champion of the early GPS project and is receiving the 2016 Marconi Prize for his work to steer GPS from an underappreciated idea to a crucial part of our lives. Brad Parkinson is a professor emeritus of aeronautics and astronautics at Stanford University School of Engineering, a former Air Force colonel. He directed the U.S. Air Force project to develop GPS. Professor Parkinson, welcome to Science Friday. Nice to have you.
Thank you so much. I enjoy your program, and I enjoy being here.
Well, thank you. Remind us what kind of navigation system we had before GPS.
Well, there were a vast number of navigation systems. Of course, for the Navy, there was a reliance to the sextant. We had a system, a radio nav system called RAND-D that was quite local. The Navy had a periodic navigation system called Transit. But none of these were continuous, three-dimensional, highly accurate systems. And as a result, they all had really serious shortcomings.
So tell us the story. You got involved in GPS with the Air Force. It wasn't guaranteed that it would go anywhere. What was the thinking here?
Well, it was almost guaranteed that it wouldn't go anywhere because it had been floundering for 4 or 5 years, and I got tabbed to go into a position as the leader of the struggling operation, and I had the right background. I had a background in space mechanics and in inertial navigation, and I also went to the Naval Academy and knew how to use a sextant. So I appreciated what it could do, but unfortunately, not only was there skepticism of what it could do, there was skepticism on whether that was where the money should be spent, and it was a constant struggle, even after we had reformulated the whole system, to try to get particularly the Air Force to agree that this was what they ought to do.
So how eventually did you work your magic to get it approved?
Well, first of all, if you're running the gauntlet like that, you cannot afford to make any serious mistakes. And I was surrounded by some wonderful people. The boss that I worked for, a three-star general, encouraged me to hire the very, very best from within the Air Force. These were bright young officers with masters and PhDs. But the other ingredient, which I think was equally important, or perhaps even more important, was that there was a high-ranking civil person in the office of the Secretary of Defense, a Deputy Secretary of Defense, who took a personal shine to this program. He came down. I spent about 3 hours with him one afternoon in Los Angeles. He apparently became convinced, and he defended me against all comers.
Who was that?
He said, that was Dr. Mal Curry. And he in essence said, Air Force, let the young colonel go off and build the system. He told them, just wait and see. It's going to do what he says.
And so tell us about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And it did.
Yeah. What were the technical problems you needed to overcome before these first satellites could be launched?
Well, first of all, you had to have a concept. And the concept was to use 4 satellites. Your scientific listeners will all realize that 3 ranges determine a point, but it turns out you needed a point in 4-dimensional space because your local clock was too crude to get down to, well, now millimeters. But the so having a good space clock, a good concept, the four satellites, and a good signal structure. This is a little esoteric, but we had a signal structure called CDMA, Co-Division Multiple Access, and this allowed all of the signals to be broadcast on exactly the same frequency. And it turns out that locks out a lot of biases and has led to millimeter-level accuracies for geodesy.
You know, what I also found interesting is you worked from the beginning to ensure that the system would be open to civilians. You found that important.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of misconceptions about that. You hear people saying, well, it was a military system and eventually made a civil system. That was not true. When I testified before Congress back about 1975, I said, this is a combination military-civil system. We originally thought the civils wouldn't get quite the military accuracy, but it turns out there are a lot of creative people out there. And in no time at all, they got close to the military accuracy. Briefly, the military tried to mess that up, but then realized there was no point in it. And since 2002, President Clinton has guaranteed that those variations in the signal will not happen again. And as a matter of fact, the new satellites don't even have the capability.
You know, we hear stories now about how easily you can buy a little object that will jam GPS from people who don't want to know in their car where they're going. But it's now interfering with the GPS systems at airports, for example. Do you see this as a threat now that needs to be thought about?
Oh, I absolutely do. And I think that there are some things coming along in technology that will help. We can build a tougher form of receiver, but it's expensive. But at the same time, we have right now only one civil signal, and that comes from the U.S. GPS. Within about 5 years, we're going to have 17 different signals from not just GPS, but from the Europeans' Galileo, which emulates us, from the Russians' GLONASS, which we can check for integrity, and even the Chinese are putting up a system, and I didn't count that in those 17 signals. So the point is that diversity helps, but I personally think a prudent person still does some cross-checks.
Yeah, because, you know, it could be used as a weapon, the jamming, could it not? If you take down the GPS system, you take down the stock market, you take down the air travel, just about everything we use.
There is a lot at stake, and fortunately, I've devoted most of my recent life to ideas on how one toughens a GPS receiver. And for safety or economic critical applications, we know how to make it very, very jam resistant. But unfortunately, those ideas have not been deployed yet.
Because?
There is another threat, I should add.
Yeah.
The FCC is contemplating putting very high-powered broadband transmitters in the adjacent band. And if that were to happen, the chances are a lot of users who rely on it now are going to be taken out.
Because of the spillover into the GPS band that could happen.
Precisely. Exactly.
So we should be aware of that. We'll talk more about it. I want to congratulate you on the Marconi Prize, winning the Marconi Prize this year. And thank you for all your contribution and your hard work.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to talk about it, and I wish you a good day.
Thank you. Brad Parkinson, Professor Emeritus of Aeronautics and Astronautics at Stanford. He directed the Air Force project to develop the GPS, and a retired colonel. Next up, imagine a group of honeybees hard at work gathering pollen in a field, flying from flower to flower, communicating to each other about where to find the best food. Yeah, that's always helpful, and that's helpful to bring in the pollinating plants that they visit in the process, bringing all that pollen in. Now imagine that the bees doing this work are robots. That's the vision driving the RoboBees project. It's a years-long effort to build tiny, flying, swarming robots that could help pollinate crops or aid in rescue and beyond. The group's latest milestone is published in Science this week, and the bees can now perch on glass or wood or even natural leaves. And you can see a video of the robots on our website at sciencefriday.com/robobees. We're talking about the flight and more of the RoboBees with my guest, Farrell Heilbling, is a PhD candidate at Harvard's School of Engineering and Applied Sciences and lead researcher on the RoboBees project. Welcome to Science Friday, Farrell.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I'm excited.
It's a kind of, they're cute little robots. Describe them to our listeners.
Yeah, they are very cute. It is a centimeter scale, biologically inspired flapping wing aerial vehicle. They weigh about 80 milligrams, so it takes about 30 of them to weigh a penny. It's a carbon fiber airframe with two piezoelectric actuators on the side, and they independently actuate the wings on the left and the right, and those create asymmetric body torques, which allow us to control flight.
Describe perfectly like an engineer. I want to compliment you.
Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. Does it fly like a bee? I mean, is the same wing action on the little robo bees?
It's very similar. So it uses the same similar amounts of power, and it flaps at similar frequencies to bees and flies or similarly sized insects. But its center of mass is well below the wings, so its body axes are slightly different than an actual honeybee.
So what was the inspiration for the project? Well, why do we need tiny flying robots that work together like bees?
I mean, I think that the inspiration was really looking at nature and bees. Bees are fast and agile insects that are able to perform quick, aggressive maneuvers. They can fly through cluttered, dynamic environments, and they can work both as an individual as well as in a collective. So you could imagine having one collective group task, but then each individual also needs to be able to carry out its individual mission, staying in the air, flying controllably, sensing the environment, and carrying a load. And there was really no robotic or mechanical equivalent that had that biological complexity at that scale. And so it was just a really rich area of engineering to explore.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it gives you a platform to study how to actually create new kinds of materials and how to work with them.
No, it definitely does. I think that one of the very interesting things that has come out of this project and that we're excited about the technology is how to manufacture at the centimeter scale. So a few decades ago, MEMS technologies had really taken off. And so there was a good example of how to manufacture at the micro scale. And then we've had larger machining technologies for a long period of time, but centimeter scale manufacturing has been really difficult. And so we've come up with a process called smart composite microstructures, which is a way to design mechanical linkages in a flat sheet. And that has allowed us to mass produce many different types of centimeter scale robots, like the RoboBee, like the Harvard Ambulatory Micro Robot, and other things as well.
Talking with Farrell Helbling of School of Engineering at Harvard on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And as I understand, it's constructed like when you fashion it, it's like a one of these pop-up books, right? It sort of pops up as it's being made and forms the RoboBee?
Yes, that is true. So the one that is in the paper is actually, some of the linkages are folded by hand, the transmission system that connects the actuator to the wing, and other things are hand assembled. But a lot of work did go into thinking about how we can put flat sheets together, laminate them, and then create scaffolding systems so that it would only take, you know, one push to get the entire structure to pop into its final shape, because that would really speed along the process to make a swarm of these.
A swarm, I'm thinking Michael Crichton now.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Prey. Remember, you read the book Prey? I advise you to read the book. Because one of the things that the little tiny flying robots did is they spoke and talked to each other. Are you trying to do that with the little mini robots, the flying one?
I think that is definitely one of the goals in the future. We haven't really done it because these robots are so small. They have such a light payload capacity that our main focus is trying to get onboard sensing so that they can sense their environment and sense their own state, onboard brain so that they can, you know, update their control parameters and stay in the air, muscle drivers to make sure that the actuators are moving correctly, and then, of course, most importantly, is a power supply.
Yeah, because they're still hooked up by a tiny little wire to a...
They are. You can see it in all the videos that we've published. The actuator signals are still given through... Those are actually four wires, four very thin wires that run to the actuators. these bees that we have now, they only have a payload capacity of about like 40 to 80 milligrams.
Tiny amount.
So it's not much room for a battery.
Yeah. Can they now perch on flowers and things like real bees? Have you taught them how to do that?
Yeah, no, they can. And I think that that's one of the great examples of why it's so important to perch, is because we don't have large power supplies on these centimeter scale robots. And so it's important to be able to pause flight while remaining aloft so that you can continue the mission while conserving energy. And so we've created these electrostatic adhesives that allow the robot to adhere to many different surfaces, like you mentioned, glass, wood, brick, natural plant structures.
Mm. And
which
so
is really exciting.
It does sound exciting. So what's your next challenge coming up, for next step you want to do?
So the next steps are definitely to integrate as much as we can on board the body of the vehicle. So like I said, brain, muscle drivers, sensors, so that these bees can control their own flight without needing external computers, external motion capture arenas. Still powered for the time being until we can come up with a solution for lightweight power. But that's our really big push. I think it would be really important to show that these bees can, you know, think and sense their environment on their own.
Well, that's terrific. We wish you great luck, and thanks for coming on today. I have to buzz off right now, so.
Thanks for having me. It's been great to talk about.
Couldn't help myself. Farrell Helbling is a PhD candidate at Harvard's School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and she's the researcher for the RoboBees Project. And as I say, go to our website at sciencefriday.com/RoboBees and watch these. These are really cute little flying bees. You won't think that they're really unreal. It was terrific. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And on the web this week, have you heard of the Blaschkas? They are a father-son glassworking duo who created Harvard's glass flower collection. But did you know they also made jellyfish and sea slugs and octopuses? And they look really astoundingly real. And you can judge for yourself at sciencefriday.com/glass. Lots of stuff besides the RoboBees on our website to take a look at all weekend. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.